Chapter 2. Demonstrations in the streets have been called for this afternoon. Prices have been soaring everywhere for months past, and the poverty is greater even than it was during the war. Wages are insufficient to buy the bare necessities of life, and even though one may have the money, it is often impossible to buy anything with it. But ever more and more gin palaces and dance halls go up, and ever more and more blatant is the profiteering and swindling. Scattered groups of workers on strike march through the streets. Now and again there is a disturbance. A rumor is going about that troops have been concentrated at the barracks, but there is no sign of it as yet. Here and there one hears cries and counter-cries. Somebody is haranguing at a street corner. Then suddenly everywhere is silence. A procession of men in the faded uniforms of the front-line trenches is moving slowly toward us. It is formed up by sections, marching in fours. Big white placards are carried before. Where is the fatherland's gratitude? The war cripples are starving. The men with one arm are carrying the placards, and they look around continually to see if the procession is still coming along properly behind them. For they are the fastest. These are followed by men with sheepdogs on short, leather leads. The animals have the red cross of the blind at their collars. Watchfully, they walk along beside their masters. If the procession halts, they sit down, and then the blind men stop. Sometimes dogs off the street will rush in among the column, barking and wagging their tails, wanting to romp and play with them. But these merely turn their heads and take no notice of all the sniffing and yapping. Yet their ears are erect, pricked and alert, and their eyes are alive. But they walk as if they no longer wish to run and to jump, as if they understood for what they are there. They have separated themselves from their fellows, as sisters of mercy separate themselves from jolly shopgirls. Nor do the other dogs persist long. After a few minutes, they give up and make off in such haste that it looks almost as if they were flying from something. Only a powerful mastiff stands still and, with front legs widely straddling, barks slowly, deep and hollow, till the procession is past. It is strange how a face without eyes alters, how in the upper half it becomes extinct, smooth and dead. And how odd the mouth is in comparison when it speaks. Only the lower half of the face lives. All these have been shot blind, and so they behave differently from men born blind. They are more violent, and at the same time more cautious, in their gestures that have not yet gained the sureness of many years of darkness. The memory of colors, of sky, earth, and twilight, still lives with them. They move still as if they had eyes. Involuntarily they lift and turn their heads to see who it is that speaks to them. Some have black patches or bandages over their eyes, but most go without them, as if by that means they would stand nearer to colors and the light. Their eyelids are withered and closed. Only the narrow strip of the lower lid still protrudes a little, blotched, wet and red like a dim, cheerless dawn. Many of them are healthy, powerful fellows with strong limbs that would like well to move freely and have play. The pale sunset of the March sky gleams behind their bowed heads. In shop windows, the first lamps are being lighted, but they hardly feel the mild, sweet air of evening on their brow. In their heavy boots, they move slowly through the everlasting darkness that stretches about them like a cloud, and troubled and persistent, their thoughts clamber up and down the meager scale of figures that would mean bread and comfort and life to them, and yet cannot be. Hunger and penury stir idly in the darkened rooms of their mind. Helpless and full of dull fear, they sense their nearness, yet they cannot see them. Nor do aught against them, but to walk slowly in their numbers through the streets, lifting up their dead faces from the darkness toward the light, in dumb appeal to others who can still see. Behind the blind come the men with one eye, the tattered faces of men with head wounds, wry, bulbous mouths, faces without noses and without lower jaws, entire faces one great red scar with a couple of holes where formerly were a mouth and a nose. But above this desolation, quiet, questioning, sad human eyes. On these follow the long lines of men with legs amputated. Some already have artificial limbs that spring forward obliquely as they walk and strike clanking on the pavement, as if the whole man were artificial, made up of iron and hinges. Others have their trouser legs looped up and made fast with safety pins. These go on crutches or sticks with black rubber pads. Then come the shakers, the shell-shocked. Their hands, their heads, their clothes, their bodies quake as though they still shuddered with horror. They no longer have control of themselves. The will has been extinguished. The muscles and nerves have revolted against the brain. The eyes become void and impotent. One-eyed and one-armed men are pushing along wicker carriages with oilcloth covers, wherein are other men so badly wounded that they can now only live in wheeled chairs. Among them, a few men come trailing a flat handcart, such as carpenters use to transport bedsteads or coffins. On it, there sits a torso. The legs are gone from the hips. It is the upper half of a powerful man, nothing more. He has broad, stalwart shoulders and a big, brave face with a heavy mustache. On his head, he wears a peaked cap. It may be that he was formerly a furniture mover. Beside him is a placard with wobbly lettering that he has, no doubt, painted himself. "I should like to walk too, mate." With solemn face, he sits there, now and then supporting himself on his arms. He will swing a little farther up the wagon so as to change his seat. A young pale fellow, without arms and legs amputated at the knees, follows after him. The knees stand in thick leather wrappings, like great hooves. It appears so odd that one involuntarily looks under the wagon, as if the legs must surely carry on there beneath it. In his arm stumps he carries a placard. "Many thousands of us are still lying in the hospitals." The procession drags slowly along the streets. Wherever it passes, all is still. Once, at the corner of Hook Street, it has to wait a long time. A new dance palace is being erected there, and the street is blocked with heaps of sand, cement mixers, and girders. Between the struts over the entrance is the name in illuminated letters, "Astoria Dance Palace and Wine Saloon." The trolley with the torso stands directly beneath it, waiting until some iron girders have been shifted. The dull glow of the lighted sign floods over him, coloring the silent face to an awful red, as if it were swelling with some terrible fury, and must suddenly burst into a hideous cry. But then the column moves on, and again it is just the face of the furniture mover, pallid from the hospital in the pale evening, and smiling gratefully as a comrade puts a cigarette between his lips. Quietly the groups pass on through the streets, without cries, without indignation, resigned, a complaint, not an accusation. They know that those who can shoot no more need not expect overmuch help. They will go on to the town hall and stand there a while. Some secretary or other will say something to them. Then they will break up and return singly to their rooms, their narrow dwellings, their pale children and their awful misery, without much hope, prisoners of the destiny that others made for them. The later it gets, the more disturbed the city becomes. I go with Albert through the streets. Men are standing in groups at every corner, Rumors are flying. It is said that the military have already fired on a procession of demonstrating workers. From the neighborhood of St. Mary's Church comes suddenly the sound of rifle shots. At first, singly, then a whole volley. Albert and I look at each other. Without a word, we set off in the direction of the shots. Ever more and more people come running toward us. "Bring rifles! The bastards are shooting!" they shout. We quicken our pace. We wind in and out of the groups. We shove our way through. We are running already. A grim, perilous excitement impels us forward. We are gasping. The racket of rifle fire increases. "Ludwig!" I shout. He is running beside us. His lips are pressed tight. The jawbones stand out. His eyes are cold and tense. Once more, he has the face of the trenches. Albert, too. I also. We run toward the rifle shots, as if it were some mysterious imperative summons. The crowd, still shouting, gives way before us. We plow our way through. Women hold their aprons over their faces and go stumbling away. A roar of fury goes up. A wounded man is being carried off. We reach the market square. There the Reichswehr has taken up a position in front of the town hall. The steel helmets gleam palely. On the steps is a machine gun, ready for action. The square is empty. Only the streets that lead into it are jammed with people. It would be madness to go farther. The machine gun is covering the square. But one man is going out, all alone. Behind him, the seething crowd surges on down the conduits of the streets. It boils out about the houses and gathers together in black clots. But the man is far in advance. In the middle of the square, he steps out from the shadow thrown by the church and stands in the moonlight. "Back!" calls a clear, sharp voice. The man is lifting his hands. So bright is the moonlight that when he starts to speak, his teeth show white and gleaming in the dark hole of his mouth. "Comrades!" All is silence. His voice is alone between the church, the great block of the town hall, and the shadow. It is alone on the square, a fluttering dove. "Comrades, put up your weapons. Would you shoot at your brothers? Put up your weapons and come over to us." Never was the moon so bright. The uniforms on the town hall steps are like chalk. The windows glisten. The moonlit half of the church tower is a mirror of green silk. With gleaming helmets and visors, the stone knights by the doorway spring forward from the wall of shadow. "Back, or we fire," comes the command coldly. I look round at Ludwig and Albert. It was our company commander. That was Hale's voice. A choking tension grips me, as if I must now look on at an execution. Hale will fire. I know. The dark mass of people moves within the shadow of the houses. It sways and murmurs. An eternity goes by. Two soldiers with rifles detach themselves from the steps and make toward the solitary man in the midst of the square. It seems endlessly long before they reach him, as though they marked time in some gray morass, glittering, tinseled rag puppets with loaded, lowered rifles. The man awaits them quietly. "Comrades," he says again as they come up. They grab him by the arms and drag him forward. The man does not defend himself. They run him along so fast that he stumbles. Cries break out behind us. The mob is beginning to move. An entire street moving slowly, irregularly forward. The clear voice commands, "Quick! Back with him! I fire!" A warning volley crackles out upon the air. Suddenly, the man wrenches himself free. But no. He is not saving himself. He is running toward the machine gun. Don't shoot, comrades! Still, nothing has happened. But when the mob sees the unarmed man run forward, it advances too. In a thin stream, it trickles along the side of the church. The next instant, a command resounds over the square. Thundering, the tick-tack of the machine gun shatters into a thousand echoes from the houses, and the bullets, whistling and splintering, strike on the pavement. Quick as lightning, we have flung ourselves behind a jutting corner of the houses. In the first moment, a paralyzing, cur-like fear seized me, quite different from any that ever I felt at the front. Then it changes into rage. I have seen the solitary figure, how he spun around and fell forward. Cautiously, I peer around the corner. He is trying to rise again, but he cannot. He only props on his arms, lifts up his pale face, and groans. Slowly the arms bend, the head sinks, and as though exceeding weary, his body sags down upon the pavement. Then the lump loosens in my throat.
No!
I cry.
No!
The cry goes up shrill between the walls of the houses. I feel myself pushed aside. Ludwig Breyer stands up and goes out over the square toward the dark lump of death.
Ludwig!
I shout. But he still goes on. On. I stare after him in horror.
Back!
Comes the command once again from the town hall steps. For a moment, Ludwig stands still.
Fire away, Lieutenant Hale!
He calls back to the town hall. Then he goes forward and stoops down to the thing lying there on the ground. We see an officer come down the steps. Without knowing quite how, we are suddenly all standing there beside Ludwig, awaiting the coming figure that, for a weapon, carries only a walking stick. He does not hesitate an instant, though there are now three of us, and we could drag him off if we wanted to. His soldiers would not dare to shoot for fear of hitting him. Ludwig straightens up.
I congratulate you, Lieutenant Hale. The man is dead.
A stream of blood is running from under the dead man's tunic and trickling into the cracks between the cobblestones. Near his right hand that has thrust forward, thin and yellow, out of the sleeve, it is gathering to a pool of blood that reflects black in the moonlight.
Breyer, says Hale.
Do you know who it is?
Asks Ludwig. Hale looks at him and shakes his head.
Max Vile.
I wanted to let him get away, says Hale after a time, almost pensively.
He is dead, answers Ludwig.
Hale shrugs his shoulders.
He was our comrade,
Ludwig goes on. Hale does not answer. Ludwig looks at him coldly.
A nice piece of work.
Then Hale stirs.
That does not enter into it, he says calmly. Only the purpose, law, and order.
Purpose, replies Ludwig contemptuously.
Since when do you offer excuse for yourself?
Purpose. Occupation. That is all that you ask. Withdraw your men so that there shall be no more shooting.
Hale makes a gesture of impatience.
My men stay where they are. If they withdrew, they would be attacked tomorrow by a mob 10 times as big. You know that yourself. In 5 minutes, I occupy all the roadheads. I give you till then to take off this dead man.
Set to it, says Ludwig to us.
Then he turns to Hale once again.
If you withdraw now, no one will attack you. If you stay, more will be killed. And through you. Do you realize that?
I realize it, answers Hale coldly.
For a second longer, we stand face to face. Hale looks at the row of us. It is a strange moment. Then something snaps. We take up the limp body of Max Weil and bear him away. The streets are again filled with people. A wide passage opens before us as we come. Cries go up.
Nuska bloodhounds! Police thugs! Murderers!
From Max Weil's back, the blood drips. We take him to the nearest house. It is the restaurant, the Holländische Diele. A couple of ambulance men are already there, binding up two people who lie on the dance floor. A woman with a blood-stained apron is groaning and keeps asking to go home. With difficulty, they detain her till a stretcher is brought and a doctor arrives. She has a wound in the stomach. Beside her lies a man still wearing his old army tunic. Both his knees have been shot through. His wife is kneeling beside him, moaning,
"He didn't do anything. He was only walking by. I was just bringing him his supper."
She points to a gray enamel billy can.
"Just his supper."
The women dancers are huddled together in a corner. The manager is running to and fro excitedly, asking if the wounded cannot be taken elsewhere. His business will be ruined if it gets out. No guest will want to dance there again. Anton Demut, in his gilded porter's uniform, has fetched a bottle of brandy and is holding it to the wounded man's lips. The manager looks on in horror and makes signs to him, but Anton takes no notice.
"Do you think I'll lose my legs?" the wounded man asks. "I'm a chauffeur."
The stretchers come. Again, shots are heard outside. We spring up. Hoots, screams, and a clatter of broken glass. We run out.
"Rip up the pavement,"
shouts someone, driving a pick into the cobbles. Mattresses are being thrown down from the houses. Chairs, a perambulator. Shots flash out from the square and now are answered from the roofs.
"Lights out!"
A man springs forward and throws a brick. Immediately, it is dark.
"Kozola!"
shouts Albert. It is he. Valentin is beside him. Like a whirlpool, the shots have drawn everyone in.
"Andrew M. Ernst! Ludwig! Albert!"
roars Kozola.
"The swine are shooting at women!"
We crouch in the doors of the houses, bullets lashing, men shouting. We are submerged, swept away, devastated, raging with hate. Blood is spurting on the pavement. We are soldiers once more. It has us again. Crashing and raging war roars above us, between us, within us. It is finished. Comradeship riddled by machine guns. Soldiers shooting at soldiers. Comrades at comrades. Ended. It is finished.